In the first two sessions in this volume on managing your time, we've talked about how to do more and more valuable things in a shorter period of time. These two sessions on mastering your time and maximizing your productivity cover the entire waterfront of improving your personal performance. They contain the distilled essence of most of what has been done on time management over the last 50 years. In this session, I'm going to talk about streamlining your life and how you can increase your overall satisfaction and happiness by actually doing fewer things and often doing completely different things. Let's start off with two models, one of a pipeline and the other of a factory. The pipeline model of personal performance is one way of looking at yourself and your life in terms of getting more things done and doing them better. If you can imagine a pipeline that stretches from point A to point B, you can also imagine how a pipeline can be an analogy for yourself and your work life. To start with, point A would be analogous to where you are now, and point B would be the equivalent of the goals that you want to accomplish sometime in the future. The way the pipeline is laid out, whether it's straight or crooked, whether it goes from point A to point B directly or indirectly, will have a lot to do with the quantity of material that flows through the pipeline, the speed at which it travels, and its level of production. That's why it's so important that you be very clear about where you want to end up before you set off in the first place. The productive capacity of the pipeline, which can be compared to your personal performance and productivity, is determined by two factors. The first, of course, is the size of the pipeline, the diameter. A large-sized pipeline will carry more material than a smaller size. In this analogy, the size of your pipeline is determined by your knowledge and skill. This is your productive capacity. The greater your level of knowledge and skill in your field, the more productive you will be and the more will flow through into your life. If you're a skilled salesperson or business executive, you have a highly developed ability to produce large quantities of high-value work. This productive capacity will be reflected in your lifestyle, in your income, and in your possibilities and opportunities for the future. If a person has a limited education or limited skills, his productive capacity is quite small. And no matter how clear his goals or how sincere his intentions, he won't be able to accomplish very much. So the first thing we know is that in order to improve the quality and quantity of the things that flow into your life, you must continually work to improve and enlarge your productive capacity, your knowledge and skill as it applies to the things you do. The second factor that determines the rate of flow through the pipeline is the velocity of the material. If the commodity flowing through the pipeline is moving at 5 miles per hour, for example, a certain amount will come out at the other end at a certain speed. However, if by the use of pumps, machinery, gravity, and other factors, the velocity or speed of material in the pipeline can be increased, far more can come through in the same period of time. In your personal pipeline of life, your velocity is determined by both the effectiveness, what you do, and the efficiency, how well you do it, of your work. One of the main purposes of time management techniques is to increase the quality and quantity of your results by making you more effective and more efficient simultaneously, holding constant for your current level of knowledge and skill. If you want more health, wealth, and happiness coming out of your pipeline of life, you need to think continually about both increasing the size of the pipeline, your productive capacity, and the velocity of the flow through your pipeline, or the effectiveness and efficiency with which you do things. And whatever the quality and quantity of your life today, it's the direct result of the productive capacity and the velocity of your pipeline to this moment. As you improve either one or both, the entire quality of your life will improve simultaneously. The second model that helps you understand time better is the factory model of life. If you've ever seen a large manufacturing plant, you've noticed that they are very long. An automobile plant, for example, can be a mile or more in length. In one end comes the raw materials, the raw steel, ready to be shaped, pressed, primed, painted, drilled, and eventually made into the undercarriage, hood, doors, and various parts of the body of the car. As the raw materials move through the plant and are processed, they're assembled with the engines, transmissions, rear ends, wheels, internal furnishings, and so on. At the end of the process, out of the far end of the factory, comes the finished car. Your life is similar to a factory in that raw material comes in one end and all of the various aspects of your life come out of the other. And the raw material of your life is time. Every day you get another 24 hours, no more and no less than anyone else. In your factory of life, you process your time. Out of the other end comes your home, your car, your bank account, your level of health and energy, your friends and relationships, and every aspect of your present and future. When you stand back and look at what your factory of life is producing with this raw material time, you may find that you're not particularly happy with some of what is coming out of the other end of the factory. If this is the case, you need to go into your factory and change the production process. You need to intervene and do something different, sometimes very different, if you want to produce something better or different in your life. You've heard the old saying, the more you do of what you're doing, the more you'll get of what you've got. Insanity has been defined as continuing to do the same things in the same way and expecting to get different results. In addition to the pipeline model and the factory model, time can also be compared to money. Time and money can either be spent or invested. If you spend either one, it's gone forever. If you invest it wisely, it will earn you a return. And a good investment of either time or money can earn you a very high return over a sustained period of time. If a person saves their money and purchases a rental property, for example, that rental property can give him or her an income for 20 or 30 or 40 years and can even be passed on to his or her children and grandchildren. On the other hand, if the person spends the money on an expensive vacation or an expensive car, the money is gone forever. One additional parallel with time and money is that they are interchangeable up to a certain point. You can exchange time for money, and you can exchange money for time. For example, if you spend money to buy books or audio cassette learning programs or to take additional courses, you can increase your earning capacity, your ability to produce valuable results for which people will pay you. You can learn how to be more valuable and to make more money. The money that you invest in learning can not only pay itself back many times over, it can save you months and even years of hard work getting to the same point in your financial life. I've spent more than 10 years and several thousand dollars studying time management. I've bought and read most of the time management books, listened to most of the audio programs, purchased most of the time planners on the market, and attended several time management seminars. Every so often, I come across an idea that has a powerful impact on my thinking about time and life. I call these paradigm shifters. These are little zingers that change my way of looking at time. I've already shared many of them with you in this program, and now I want to share three more with you. The first paradigm shifter for me was learning that every action or inaction involves a choice between what is more important and what is less important. Every time you do something, you're making a statement about where that activity ranks in your hierarchy of values and importance. In fact, your entire life is a reflection of your choices up to now. A successful, happy person is one who has made good choices, and a frustrated, unhappy person is one who has made poor choices. Improving the quality of your choices leads inevitably to improving the overall quality of your life and your results. In everything you do, you're making a choice, one way or the other. The second paradigm shifter for me was discovering the law of the excluded alternative. This means that doing one thing means not doing something else. Every choice of a particular activity involves a rejection of all other possible activities at that particular moment. For example, every choice you make in purchasing something implies a rejection of all other choices at that moment. When you choose to marry a person, you simultaneously reject all other persons in the world that you could marry. Choosing one thing means not choosing someone or something else. You can only do or have one thing at a time, and you can always tell, and so can others, what you consider the most important by what you do, by the actions you take, by your choices at any given moment. A primary reason for success is that people choose deliberately to do things that enhance their lives more than other things. The reason for failure is that people choose to do things that do not enhance their lives or even worse, make their lives and relationships worse than they would have been if they had done nothing at all. The third paradigm shifter for me was learning that setting priorities means setting posteriorities as well. This is an amazingly important fact. Each time you choose to do something, in order to do it properly, you must simultaneously decide what it is that you are going to stop doing, your posteriorities. To put it another way, taking hold means letting go. Getting in requires getting out. Starting one thing means stopping something else. Most people feel overwhelmed with the pace of modern life. It's been estimated that you make more decisions in an average month than your grandparents made in a lifetime. If you live in the city, you're exposed to as many as 5,000 commercial messages per day. You have dozens of channels to choose from on television, on the radio. You are inundated with mail, correspondence, and telephone calls. You're busy from dawn to dusk, and you probably don't feel that you're getting enough sleep. In one study, 62% of women reported that fatigue was their number one problem. When they got up in the morning, the first thing they thought about was what time they could go back to sleep that night. In other words, whatever you're doing, your dance card is full. You have not been bored for so long that you can't even remember. You're swamped with work and activities. You have places to go, people to see, and things to do. You don't have a spare minute. You are probably living on the run. The point is this. If you agree to do something else in addition to what you're already doing, you have no spare time available. You may have had spare time in the distant past, perhaps as a teenager, but you have no spare time now. Therefore, before you agree to do anything, you have to stop and think about the things you are going to stop doing in order to do something new. The problem with most people is that they continually add more time-consuming activities to their lives without thinking about the time-consuming activities that they're going to have to cut back on or discontinue altogether. With mergers, acquisitions, downsizing, cutbacks, and the speed of technological change, more and more people are being required to perform more and more functions. One of the best things an employee can do is to go to his or her boss with a list of everything that's on their plate and tell the boss that they can't do everything. If you're in this situation, tell your boss that you want to do the very best job possible and ask him or her to set specific priorities on your tasks. What does your boss want you to do above all else? Make it clear that doing one thing means you won't be able to do other things on the list. There's only so much time in the day, and you cannot, even with the best time management techniques, do more than a certain amount. This brings us to one of the most important thinking tools in modern life. It's called zero-based thinking. Peter Drucker, perhaps the most admired management consultant of the 20th century, has been emphasizing the importance of this concept for many years. Zero-based thinking means that you mentally draw a line under everything that you're doing, under all the decisions that you've made in the past, and you ask yourself this key question. Is there anything that I'm doing right now that, knowing what I now know, I wouldn't get into? This is an incredibly difficult question for most people. It requires tremendous courage to ask and answer this question of yourself and your life. I can share this idea with an audience of 1,000 people and ask them if there's anyone in the audience who is not in a situation that, knowing what they now know, they wouldn't get into in the first place if they had to do it over. Of 1,000 people, there is not one who can raise their hand and say that there's nothing that they would change if they had to do it over. However, it's not possible to organize, reorganize, manage, and manipulate your time to be more productive and effective if, deep in your heart, you wouldn't even get into your current situation if you had to do it over again. There's no point in trying to be more effective and more efficient in your work if you don't like the job or if you're not suited for the position in the first place. There's no point in taking lessons on how to live more productively with a situation that you dislike intensely. And the worst of all is when you're in a relationship that, knowing what you now know, you wouldn't get into in the first place. So ask yourself, knowing what you now know, is there any situation in your life that you wouldn't get into in the first place if you had to do it over? If the answer is yes, then your next question should be, how do I get out of this situation and how fast? Too many people are spinning their wheels with their lives on hold, trying to make a situation work that they'd rather be out of. However, all progress, all improvement requires change. And change almost invariably means letting go of the old so that you can embrace the new. It means letting go of something of lower value so that you can embrace something of higher value. Start by asking yourself, with regard to your relationships, knowing what you now know, which of your relationships would you choose not to get into in the first place? This takes tremendous courage, as I mentioned, because many people are in relationships that they recognize are not working and are not likely to work, but they fear conflict and confrontation. If you're a manager, look at your staff and ask yourself, knowing what you now know, is there anyone that you would not hire if you had to do it over again? Almost every manager I've ever met has admitted, in all honesty, that they have employees they would not choose if they had to do it over again. Are there any investments that you're in, or is there anything that you're purchasing that, knowing what you now know, you wouldn't get into in the first place? If so, what can you do to minimize your exposure? How can you get out of it if possible? Are there any activities that you've gotten involved in that you don't particularly care about? Knowing what you now know, would you get into these activities again if the choice were offered? If the answer is no, how would you get out and how fast? This is a terribly important part of time and life management. And the way that you can tell if there is something in your life that you should not be in is through the medium of stress. Invariably, a situation that is wrong for you will be causing you stress and anxiety. You will think about it too much of the time. You will talk about it at home. It'll be on the top of your mind and will come out in casual conversation. Since one of your responsibilities is to maximize your return on emotional energy, if the situation is wrong for you, you will find that it is draining emotional energy from you, sometimes at an incredible rate. It is, in fact, a lousy investment, and you should get out of it as soon as possible. Here's another paradigm shifter I've found. It's the discovery that the value of anything can be determined by how much of your time and your life you're willing to trade for it. The key word here is the word trade. Since you only have a certain number of hours and minutes in each day, whatever you choose to do, you are trading part of your life for that activity. You are simultaneously, because of the law of the excluded alternative, taking that time away from other areas of your life. For example, if you make $500 per week and it costs you $400 per week to live, a $100 expenditure or donation represents 1 week of work out of your life. This isn't to say that you should or should not buy a certain thing. It's only to point out that you are trading a week of your life when you make that kind of expenditure. Everything you buy, everything you do, is costing you a chunk of life that is gone forever and will never come back. Your job is to look at yourself, your time, your life, and your activities in terms of how much of your precious time you're willing to trade, knowing that you will no longer have it to trade for some other activity. Your perspective on time, how you value it and how you allocate it, in both the short and the long term, is a major determinant of everything that happens to you. Dr. Edward Banfield's work on success in America shows that success is largely attitudinal. It depends upon a person's time perspective. An individual with a long time perspective, one who takes the long view into consideration when making their day-to-day decisions, is far more likely to be economically successful than a person who ignores the long view. In addition to long time perspective, making sacrifices in the short term so as to enjoy greater rewards in the long term, you must also develop a short time perspective. This means that you allocate your time in small amounts. The highest paid professionals in our society, doctors, lawyers, dentists, architects, engineers, and so on, allocate their time in blocks of 1/10 of an hour. If they charge $200 per hour for their services, they bill you for the number of 6-minute blocks that they spend on your case or situation. If they spend 5 minutes on a telephone conversation, you'll get a bill for 1/10 of an hour, and the bill will be for $20. People at the top of their occupations or professions, salespeople, executives, or others, who are earning high incomes, have very tight time planning. They allocate their time in 10 and 15-minute chunks. they give a lot of thought to how their time will be spent. When they drive or travel, they use every minute productively. On the other hand, sadly enough, you can tell a person who's having financial troubles by simply asking him or her how their day is scheduled. People who aren't making very much money have very loose schedules. Research shows that the average blue-collar worker thinks in terms of two-week pay periods and seldom thinks more than two pay periods ahead. As one moves up the socioeconomic ladder, the time horizons become narrower and narrower. People who are doing poorly in selling, for example, think in terms of the morning and the afternoon. People who are doing well in selling think in terms of 15-minute blocks, starting from 8 or 8:30 in the morning, and sometimes earlier, through to 6 o'clock in the evening, and sometimes later, and even have plans for additional work later on after they get home. You can increase your income by simply beginning right now to plan your time as tightly as possible every single day using some of the ideas that we've discussed in this and previous sessions. There's an endless amount of work that's been done on success and failure, on self-esteem and self-image, on goals, personal productivity, and performance. The bottom line of all this work, however, has never really changed. If you could boil it and distill it down to a single phrase, that phrase would be self-discipline. Successful, happy people have more self-discipline than unsuccessful, unhappy people. People who are moving up rapidly are more disciplined than people who are not. People who are accomplishing worthwhile things with their lives have a greater capacity to discipline their time and their appetites than those who do not. Throughout all of history, the person with the greatest self-control and self-discipline has always dominated those with less. In its simplest terms, self-discipline means the ability to have dinner before dessert. You are surrounded by 1,000 voices clamoring for your attention every single day, and almost every one of them is encouraging you to have dessert before dinner, and even dessert instead of dinner. They want you to have fun until your daddy takes your T-bird away. Advertisements shout out at you to buy now, and no payments until January. Much of life can be divided into dinner activities and dessert activities. However, dessert has a specific place in the meal and is served at a specific time. Dessert comes after the main course has been consumed. Dessert is not served first. If you eat dessert before you eat the main course, an unfortunate thing happens. It kills your appetite for the main course. Not only that, but because dessert usually contains a lot of sugar and fat, if you eat too much dessert rather than healthy main courses, it will eventually affect you physically, mentally, and emotionally. If you come home every night and eat chocolate cake and ice cream, you'll be overweight, you'll do less exercise, and you'll sit around and watch more television. The sugar will cause you to be more depressed, and you'll have less energy, less enthusiasm, and a crummier personality. By the same token, if you eat a rich, nourishing dinner full of healthy foods, your appetite for dessert will be greatly reduced. In many cases, you'll find that you have no interest in dessert at all. Now, what does this mean to you? Well, when you come home at night, dinner activities are things like talking to your spouse and playing with your children. Dessert activities are watching television, cracking a beer, and reading the newspaper. When you get home, you always have a choice between a dinner activity and a dessert activity. The question is, which are you going to do first? Albert Hubbard once defined self-discipline as the ability to make yourself do what you should do, when you should do it, whether you feel like it or not. The critical expression here is contained in the words, feel like it or not. You see, anybody can do it if they feel like it, if it feels good, if it's fun and enjoyable. It's when you don't feel like doing it, when it's hard, when you're tired and worn out, and you do it anyway because it's the right thing to do, that you demonstrate character. And character is what it's all about. One of the great aims of life is to develop character, to become a fine human being in the course of your personal evolution. And the hallmark of the man or woman with character is self-discipline and self-restraint. The more you practice self-discipline, the better you feel about yourself and the better a person you become. The less you practice self-discipline, the worse you feel about yourself and the less admirable a person you become. So in every case, ask yourself, Is this a dinner activity or a dessert activity? And whatever the answer, deliberately choose to engage in the dinner activities until they're all done before you engage in the dessert activities. Out of this simple choice will issue all the results of your life. Some years ago, Henry Hazlitt wrote a little book called Economics in One Lesson. Hazlitt was a writer for Time magazine for many years. He studied people, personalities, economics, and politics in great detail. Finally, he wrote his little book, which was not well received by many politicians, but which went on to sell more than 1 million copies. Many people who read the book were forever changed in their attitude and their perspective on the world around them. What Hazlitt said, in short, was that all of wisdom is the accurate consideration of the secondary consequences of a particular act or decision. He said that the primary consequences are almost invariably positive and favorable. That's why a person engages in the activity in the first place. But, he said, it's the secondary consequences of the act with which we have to live. And often, the secondary consequences are far worse than if nothing had been done at all. For example, the primary consequences of going out and having a couple of drinks after work are immediate enjoyment, socializing with friends, personal gratification, relaxation, and a little fun. The secondary consequences are that for the rest of the evening, the person will be too befuddled to study something that will help them or to read anything of consequence or even to relate intelligently with the people around them. The drinker will not be back to his or her normal self until the following day. The primary consequences are fun, but the secondary consequences are negative. It's the same when a person decides to exercise or not to exercise, to eat healthy foods or to eat sugary, fatty foods. Secondary consequences kick in when a person decides to spend their evenings watching television versus spending their evenings at the community college, upgrading their skills and abilities so that they can be more productive in their work. Secondary consequences kick in when a person spends much of their time bowling or socializing with their friends or doing work that they couldn't get done at the office because they used their time so poorly, versus the person using their time efficiently and effectively and spending ample time in the evening with their spouse and children. In every case, primary consequences are usually fun and enjoyable, but the secondary consequences can be disastrous. In every situation, the wise person gives a lot of thought to the likely secondary consequences of the act, and the ability to consider secondary consequences is the hallmark of self-discipline and character. It is the true demonstration that the individual has developed a long time perspective. The accurate projection of secondary consequences and the selection of one's activities to assure that they are the very best possible is the absolute prerequisite for success, happiness, and achievement in America. Like the game of chess, always be asking yourself before you make any move or decision, what is likely to happen as the result of this decision in the long term? What might the likely consequences be? If the likely consequences can be extremely positive, then it's probably a good thing to do. If the likely consequences can be extremely negative, then you must be very careful in your decisions. Already today in America, a person with a college degree is earning 30 to 50% more per month than a person with only a high school graduation certificate. The extra 2 to 4 years of college pay themselves back in higher earnings in almost the same time that it took to get the degree. From then on, the more educated person will earn more and more as he or she progresses through life. The uneducated person will be stuck in place, locked in a low-level job, and doomed to continue at a low salary unless and until he or she aggressively upgrades his or her education. The person who works hard in high school to get good grades and then scrimps and saves and sacrifices to go on to college is a person who is very concerned about the secondary consequences of his or her behavior. While all their friends are out laughing and partying and having a good time, he or she is plodding away with a view to the long term. And before the dust settles, the person who is willing to pay the price early in the game is living in a big house on the hill and driving a nice car, while the others are spinning their wheels and talking about how lucky he or she was to be in the right place at the right time. There is a law of forced efficiency in personal management, which says that although there's never enough time to do everything, there's always enough time to do the most important things. Your job is to think before acting and then make sure that you are doing the things that are most important rather than the things that are fun, easy, urgent, or convenient. Your job is to stand back from your life and continually ask, is this a good use of my time? The very worst use of time is to do very well what need not be done at all. Many people become so busy doing unimportant things that they confuse activity with accomplishment. They don't stand back to look at their lives and realize that they're busy doing things that don't really matter. If they weren't done at all, it would make very little difference to their long-term success or failure. For example, a person could plan their work days to have the very longest and finest coffee breaks and lunch hours that one could ever want for the next 30 years, and it would have almost zero impact on the important things that he or she wants to do with his or her life. Someone could read every sports page of every newspaper that's published within 1,000 miles every day for the next 25 years, and it would have virtually zero impact on their life, their career, and their relationships. The most important thing that you do in time management is to choose. It is the highest demonstration of intelligence and wisdom. Your ability to make the right choices is the key to everything else. Your life is where it is and what it is as a direct result of the way you have used your time in the past. You can change the results and accomplishments of your life by changing the way you use your time from this moment forward. And you are always free to choose. So, choose well. Everywhere I go in America, people are asking me how they can maintain balance between their work and their family. Everyone feels that they have too much to do in too little time. They feel that their relationships and especially their children are suffering because of the incessant demands on their time from work and they don't know what to do about it. Because of these precarious economic times, they're very concerned about holding on to their jobs, but they're equally concerned about maintaining the quality of their home life. The issue of balance is not going to go away. It's a critical issue and will be important for the rest of your life. If anything, the speed of change and the demands of work will intensify in the months and years ahead. They will not ease up. The changes, if they're going to be made, must be made in the hearts and minds and attitudes of the individual. As a professional speaker and seminar leader, I travel about 150 days per year. I often leave on Sunday morning for the airport, and I don't get back until late Friday night. And yet I have 4 happy, healthy children and a beautiful wife. Our home life is relaxed and characterized by a lot of laughter and fun. I know a lot about the subject of balance because it's a major issue for me, and especially since my children are young and need my time and attention more than at any other period of their lives. I've come to a few conclusions regarding the issue of balance, how you can achieve it and maintain it, and what follows are my ideas. Many men and women have found these observations to be extremely helpful, and I hope that you do as well. Through a lifetime of study of philosophy, psychology, religion, and metaphysics, I've come to the conclusion that the simplest measure of how well you are doing in your life is your level of happiness. How happy you are is the very best indicator that your life is going well or not. At any time, you can look around you at your life and you will find the very best parts of your work and home are those parts where you feel the happiest and most at peace. You'll also find that the areas where you feel unhappy, fearful, or anxious are your major problem areas and your major sources of stress. The simple conclusion of this is that you should organize your life so that you have more and more parts of it where you are happy and fewer parts of it where you are unhappy. This idea of using happiness as your barometer, as your inner guide to what is right for you, makes many people uncomfortable. Many people have been brought up being told over and over that their own personal happiness is of secondary importance. When I was growing up, I was told that the purpose of my life was to make others happy, and if I managed to eke out a little happiness on the way through, then I should consider myself darn lucky. But the very idea of setting my own happiness as the centerpiece of my life to guide my decision-making was considered to be selfish, wrong, and unacceptable. Abraham Lincoln once wrote, "You cannot help the poor by becoming one of them." Well, you cannot help people to be happy by being unhappy yourself. The idea that a person can suffer for the happiness of others is rather silly. You can't give away what you don't have. You can't make others happy unless you are a happy person yourself. If you really love your spouse, then you should go to work on yourself and make yourself a positive and cheerful person who is a joy and a delight to be around. If you really love your children, then be a happy parent that your children look forward to seeing every day. Recent research suggests that children are much better off with a single parent who is happy than with two parents who are at each other's throats all the time. The old idea of staying together for the children is dead wrong. There's probably nothing more soul-destroying for a child than to live in a house characterized by animosity and bickering all the time he or she is growing up. Nature is really wonderful with regards to giving us everything we need to enjoy our lives. Nature builds mechanisms into us that let us know if something is good or bad for us, right or wrong. For example, if you touch something that is hot, you jerk your hand away immediately so that you don't burn yourself. As an adult, you've had enough experiences with hot surfaces to know that they are dangerous and to be avoided. Nature gives you the sensation of physical pain as a signal to protect you from hurting yourself. It's a mechanism designed to assure your survival as long as possible. Any sensation of pain anywhere in your body is instantly recognized by yourself as being somehow wrong, and if it persists, you take steps to investigate it and, whenever possible, to get rid of it. Interestingly enough, when children are very young, they've not yet developed this understanding of the meaning of pain as a protective device. They don't understand it. I remember my son Michael, when he was 3 years old, touching a hot stove that burned his finger. Instead of jerking his finger away, he stood there with his finger on the stove, howling with pain. It was only for a couple of seconds, and we grabbed him and put ice on his finger, but he still looked at the stove with a mystified look, wondering what happened. Now he's 10 years old, and he's both quick and sensitive to pain of any kind. He immediately responds and jerks his hand away from anything that might be hot enough to hurt him. By the same token, nature has installed a guidance mechanism in you to tell you what is right and what is wrong for you in your personal, emotional, and business life. It is the sense of happiness versus unhappiness. All you have to do is to listen to yourself. When you're doing and saying what is right for you in any situation, you feel calm, comfortable, and happy inside. When you are doing or saying or experiencing anything that is wrong for you, you feel nervous, angry, or fearful. In a way, you can close your eyes and listen to your inner sense of happiness, and you'll always know what the right thing is for you to do. It's remarkable that a person who would never think of sitting on a hot stove and letting it burn them physically will stay in a bad situation for months and even years where they are being emotionally burned. Instead of listening to their feelings of unhappiness and accepting them as a guide or as a barometer, they ignore them, suppress them, repress them, and use a whole series of psychological mechanisms to avoid dealing with the fact that they're miserable. One of the characteristics of the most successful men and women in America is their clarity about only doing things that make them happy. They are equally as adamant about refusing to get involved with people or situations that make them unhappy for any reason. And if they get into a situation where they find they are unhappy, they deal with it directly and they remove either the situation or themselves so that they can get back to feeling at peace. Many people stay in an unhappy situation because they think that somehow they're going to gain something from the situation that will more than compensate for the misery that they experience. This seldom happens. When you think back through your life and the times that you have spent unhappily with people and situations, you will probably recall that you never did get anything worthwhile as a result. Whether it was a bad relationship, a bad job, or a bad business situation, in retrospect, you would never have gotten into it, and once in, you would have gotten out a lot sooner. Nothing good comes of something bad. One of the hallmarks of the totally honest person, of a man or woman with high integrity, is that they absolutely refuse to subject themselves to a negative situation that makes them feel unhappy for any period of time. They will either take action to change it, or they will walk away. They will pay whatever price it takes, but they will not sacrifice their happiness or their emotional integrity for someone or something else. Superior people have learned from long experience that it doesn't pay anyway. Once you've decided to use your own happiness as the guide by which you make your decisions and judge your actions, your next step is to realize that fully 85% of your happiness comes from your relationships with others. Of course, fully 85% of your unhappiness comes from your relationships with others as well. We'll go into this in greater detail later in this course. But the bottom line is that most of our joys in life come from people, and most of your sorrows come from people as well. If you're really concerned about your happiness, you must be really concerned about the way you interact with others. People are not peripheral to a good life. They are the very heart and essence of a good and happy life. The fact is, you need a balance between your family and your work to be happy. The natural tendency of men, especially, is to get out of balance, to go to extremes. It may start off gradually, getting caught up in your work, but if you don't watch it carefully, you can become more and more absorbed in what you're doing, often to the point where you start to take your family for granted. Fortunately, women are far more balanced and stable, like the keel of a sailing ship, and they perform the function of reining in these extremist tendencies in the home. My wife Barbara, for example, is very clear about not allowing me to get so busy and so committed that I begin depriving her or my children of my time and attention. For several years, as my career in professional speaking was getting going, I would accept almost any engagement and travel almost any distance to give a seminar or a presentation. I soon found myself speaking on Saturdays and Sundays on the other sides of the country and not coming home for 10 and 12 days at a time. On one speaking trip some years ago, I was gone for 3 weeks. At this point, Barbara put her foot down. Enough was enough. She got me to agree, which I did reluctantly, to not accept speaking engagements on the weekend so that I would be home every Saturday and Sunday. Like most men, I fought it with the best arguments and rationalizations I could muster up, but I finally gave in. It turned out to be one of the best things I've ever done. Now, I never accept speaking engagements on weekends, except for rare occasions when I can bring Barbara or my children with me. I am home virtually every single weekend, and that now spills over into both Fridays and Mondays, so though I travel so much, I still spend a lot of time with my family. To get your life in balance and keep it there, it's essential that you take time to reflect and think about who you are, where you're going, and what you really care about. Just as we did in strategic thinking, you begin with your values. You ask yourself continually, what is really important to me? What do I really care about? Why am I doing what I'm doing? The main reason that people get out of balance is that they stop thinking and they mask this fact with frantic activity. They get busier and busier and more tired, doing more and more things of lesser and lesser value. They feel swamped, like a rat on a treadmill, going faster and faster and not getting anywhere. And they don't know how to stop because they've lost sight of the fact that their ability to think is the most powerful tool they have in the whole world to ensure a happy, healthy life. Some people have to have massive heart attacks to slow them down and get them to think. Others have to have life-threatening illnesses. Some have to have their marriages collapse. We humans are funny in that often we need a good slap in the face in order to get our attention. Once you've sat down and thought through your values, you should come to the conclusion that the people in your life are more important than anything else. Most parents would die for their children. But dying is not the question. The question is, will they live for them? That is a much more difficult issue to deal with. Once you've decided on your values, take some time with a pad and paper to describe your ideal lifestyle. If you could design the perfect life from dawn to dusk, from Monday to Friday, from the beginning of the year to the end of the year, how would you like to live? Just as we talked about in describing or writing out your dream list, you should sit with your spouse and design your dream life. Where would you like to live? What would you like to be doing? How many hours a day would you like to be doing it? What would you like to be doing in your leisure time? If your company or industry collapsed completely and left you out on the street free to make any choice at all about your future occupation, what would you want to do? Who would you want to do it with? How much would you like to be earning? go right through your list of different goals and decide your level of health and fitness, your ideal weight, the subjects you'd want to learn more about, the activities you'd like to engage in, the people you'd like to socialize with, and especially the time that you'd like to spend with the people who are closest to you. Once you've worked out a definition of your ideal lifestyle, take a look at where you are now. Imagine that you have a pad of paper and you draw a ball on one side, the left side of the paper, and you draw another ball on the right side of the paper. In the first ball, you write now, and in the second ball, you write 5 years. Then you ask yourself, what would I have to do starting today to begin moving from where I am now to where I want to be in 5 years in each of the different areas of my life? The best way to predict your future is to create it. The best way to assure that you are where you want to be in 5 years is to design it as you would design a house. Then, begin building your life step by step and day by day so that 5 years from now you arrive at your pre-planned destination. How can you tell if you're living consistent with your values and if the things that you're doing on a day-to-day basis are moving you towards your ideal lifestyle? Well, it's easy. Whenever you're out of alignment with your true values, you experience stress and irritability. All negative manifestations of your personality, including complaining, criticizing, condemning, and outbursts of anger or frustration, are all indications that your life is out of balance. Just as a plane landing on instruments will start to hear a rapid beeping from the control panel when the plane gets off course, you will feel a sense of distress whenever you get off course in your own life. The word here, as we discussed earlier, is congruency. It is only when your inner values and beliefs and your outer goals and activities are congruent that you feel truly at peace with yourself. It is only at this time that you are really effective as a person and in everything you do. Keep working on your dream list. Keep thinking about your ideal life. Keep imagining that you had all the money that you need and that you have no limitations on anything that you could be or have or do. Imagine that all you have to do is to decide exactly what you want, and the opportunity to accomplish it will materialize. Don't get bogged down in the limitations and restrictions of your current situation, your current finances, your current relationships, and your current job. Put them aside while you look into the future and imagine what kind of a life you would create for yourself if anything was possible. To achieve and maintain balance in your life, you can use the teeter-totter model of thinking. As you know, whatever weight is put on one end of the teeter-totter must be matched with an equal weight on the other end of the teeter-totter if the teeter-totter is to stay in balance. Well, your life is very much the same. As you begin to spend more time at your work at one end of the teeter-totter, you need to balance your life by spending more time with your family and your relationships. John Nesbitt, in his book Megatrends, described the increasing pace of technological development and said that as our lives become more high-tech, they must become more high-touch as well. This is probably the best way I've ever heard it put. High-tech can refer to anything in the material world. Any of your activities involved with getting and spending, with making a living, with moving upward and onward in your career and financial life. These are all hard areas that are important to your well-being and to the fulfilling of your potential as a person. However, they must be balanced with the soft areas, with more attention to the people you care about and the people who care about you. This brings us right back to the subject of priorities versus posteriorities. To do more of one thing, you must do less of another. If you're out of balance in any way, to get back into balance, you must change the way you are allocating your time. You must stand back and look at your life and decide what things you're going to diminish or discontinue so that you can have more time for the other end of the teeter-totter, so that you can get your life back in balance and harmony. What should you be doing more of to ensure greater health and happiness and harmony in your life? What should you be doing less of? What activities are you engaged in today if you had to start them over again, you wouldn't get into them in the first place? Use zero-based thinking in every area of your life and be extremely diligent about extracting yourself from time-consuming activities that are not as valuable and important to you as others might be. If you look at your 24 hours per day as chips given to you to spend as you like, a good exercise is for you to treat your time like money and continually ask yourself how you can best spend it to achieve maximum satisfaction. Before you do anything, consider that you are spending a sum of money and ask yourself if this is the very best use of this money at this time. Between the thought and the action, there is always a moment for reflection and hesitation. It is in that moment when you decide what is really important to you that all the great issues in life are decided. If somebody asks you to do something that will take up a good deal of time, ask the person for 24 hours to think about it. Instead of saying yes or no immediately, take some time to turn it over in your mind. After 24 hours, you can politely decline the offer by saying that your time is fully accounted for. This always avoids rejecting anyone and gives you a chance to reflect on your situation before getting into something that turns out to be difficult to get out of. Perhaps the most important thing you do in achieving balance in your life is to set peace of mind as your highest goal, and then organize your time and your life around it. Your inner voice, your intuition, is your inner guide to peace and contentment, and it will never lead you astray. When you set peace of mind as your umbrella goal, and you organize all of the other goals and activities of your life under that umbrella, you'll probably never make another mistake. Setting peace of mind as your major organizing principle is a mark of the highest integrity. It takes tremendous courage to do because you'll always be tempted by so many other things. The people around you are largely indifferent to whether or not you have peace of mind, and they're far more concerned about your doing what it takes to make them happy more than anything else. When you decide not to do something because it doesn't feel right, many people will be amazed that you would allow your feelings to determine your decisions. But your feelings are not to be taken lightly. Women are smarter than men in that they listen to their intuitions far more than men do. They trust their feelings. If it doesn't feel right, a woman is far less likely to proceed than a man is. Men can be easily swayed by other emotions, such as greed or ambition, but women are usually too smart for that. They realize that if their gut feeling is that something is amiss with the person or situation, they would be best advised to pass it by. And they are virtually always right. Here is the key to balance. It's simple, but not easy. It's easy to explain, but complex to practice. It is this. Do just two things. Work and family, especially when your family is in the formative stages. If you're single, replace the word family with relationships. You must keep your life in balance by allocating ample time to spend with other people. If you don't, you'll tend to go to extremes, to become narrow in your focus, and to be critical and driven in your behavior. It's only your constant interaction with other people from other areas of life that keeps you in balance. With regard to dividing your time between your work and your family, this is the solution that I found worked for me and which works for thousands of people all over the country. Imagine that you have a pitcher of water and that you have two large glasses and several small glasses. Now imagine that this pitcher is the amount of time that you have each day or each week. Imagine that the two large glasses represent your work and your family life and the smaller glasses represent all of the other activities that you can engage in. As a mental tool, think of filling both of the large glasses, work and family, to the brim, and then allocating whatever water is left among the other glasses based on their importance to you. The big mistake that many people make is that they allocate their water, their time, first of all to their work, and then to many of the other smaller glasses, and they put what is left over in the glass that represents the family. Very often, what is left over is not enough to fill the glass. It's not enough to fulfill your responsibilities, and your natural tendency is to ask in dismay, where did all the time go? Develop the habit of working all the time you work. Put more of yourself into the time at work. Don't waste time when you're on the job. If you work from 9 to 5, be like a thoroughbred racehorse coming out of the gate at Santa Anita and go full blast all the way around the course. Don't stop and smell the roses along the way. Work all the time you work. Here's an important point. If you socialize with someone at work, whether you particularly care about the person or not, the work that you have to do doesn't go away. It's still there. You still have to get it done if you want to keep your job. However, the time that you spend socializing at work has to be taken away from somewhere. Since work time is hard time and family time is soft time, your natural tendency will be to take the hard time you need away from the soft time. When you waste your time socializing at work, you're actually taking time away from your family by spending time with that other person. The question you have to ask is this what you want to do? Is it more important that you shoot the breeze with people at work or that you spend time with the people you love more than anyone else in the world? If you really care about your family, you will work all the time you work. You will put your head down and get this job done so that you don't come home with your briefcase stuffed full of projects that you weren't able to complete because you used your time poorly. When you're at home, be with your family 100% of the time. Don't make the mistake of being just physically present, watching television, reading the newspaper, or even worse, working on stuff from the office or on the telephone. You need to be there with your family for them to get the full value and benefit of your presence. They need your focused, undivided attention. They need you to look them in the eyes and talk to them and ask them questions and listen. They need the whole person, not just the physical presence somewhere in the house. To gain time, remember the law of the excluded alternative. If you spend time doing one thing, you don't have the time left to do something else. Limit or restrict television, newspapers, and outside activities. Remember the metaphor of the water pitcher. Television and newspapers are the little glasses. Your family is the biggest and most important glass of all. As Rabbi Kushner once wrote, "I never spoke to a businessman on his deathbed who said, 'Gee, I wish I'd spent more time at the office.'" If you sit and watch television while your family needs your time and attention, you are unwittingly telling them that the television is more important than they are. If your spouse wants to talk to you and you're reading the newspaper, a book, or the mail, if you continue reading, you are signaling to your spouse that what is written on the printed page is more important than he or she is. You need to spend unbroken chunks of time with the most important people in your life. You cannot do it on the run. You need 30, 60, and 90-minute chunks of time where you do nothing but speak with the other person. You must be creative, by the way, in organizing these blocks of time. One of the best ways is to take each of your children out for lunch or dinner separately. That gives you 2 or 3 hours of driving, sitting, and talking with your child. Parents need to get away together with each other on a regular basis, including long, leisurely dinners and a 2 or 3 day weekend away together at least once every 3 months. And it's not a matter of whether you can afford these weekends or not. The fact is that in this busy, busy world, you cannot afford not to take time with your spouse. With your spouse, pick a place to go that is 2 or 3 hours' drive away. When you drive, leave the radio off and just talk. There is something about an extended car trip that brings out an enormous amount of open and honest communication. You will often hear and learn things that will amaze you, and they would not come out if you were not sitting in that car for a long, extended period of time with no other option but to communicate. Here is my law of balance in relationships. This is the summary principle of everything we've talked about so far. It is simply this. It's quantity of time at home and quality of time at work that counts. And the key to happiness and success is for you not to mix them up. Your family requires a large quantity of time. I said earlier that time is indispensable, especially for relationships. Time is like sunshine for flowers. Just as flowers cannot get by without sunshine, relationships cannot survive without an investment of time. They need you to be there for extended periods. Interestingly enough, quality time, which has no place in relationships at all, only comes about as a function of quantity of time. Those precious moments that you share with the most important people in your life come unbidden. You cannot plan for them or dictate them. You can just provide large quantities of time and hope that those wonderful moments will occur as they usually do unexpectedly. It's quality of time at work that counts, but not quantity. The quantity of what you produce in your work life is determined by the quality with which you perform your functions. Quality refers both to how well you do your job and to how well you manage your time so that you are always working on high-value tasks. The big problem arises when people confuse quantity and quality, and they try to spend quantities of time at work and then give quality time at home. It simply doesn't work. You cannot exchange one for the other. As a child psychologist wrote recently, "I never met a child in trouble who said, 'I wish my parents had spent more quality time with me.'" In the session on the Master Skill of Success, I gave you a values question, which was, what would you do, how would you spend your time if you learned today that you only had 6 months to live? The purpose of this question was to help you clarify what is really important to you. Now, imagine that this was real. You would enjoy perfect health for 6 months, but because of an incurable illness, you would pass away in 180 days. You go home, and you make out a plan for how you're going to spend your time, what you're going to do, and especially who you're going to spend your days and hours with for your final 6 months. By the next morning, the doctor phones you up and explains that they have a glitch in their hospital computer, and somehow it got the digits wrong. It isn't 6 months that you have left to live, it's only 6 weeks. Now what do? You immediately sit down, you tear up your old list and design a brand new plan for the last 6 weeks of your life. You delete a lot of things that you might have done if you'd had 6 months. You now start thinking very carefully and very seriously about what is really important to you in your final weeks. Then, the next morning, the doctor's nurse phones. She explains that they still haven't gotten the glitches out of the computer, and that because you have a rare disease, the actual amount of time you have left is only 6 days. What do you do now? Well, you quickly sit down and reorganize your plans for your last 6 days on Earth. You throw out and eliminate any activity that's not absolutely vital in terms of what you really care about. Several things that you were going to get done go right into the wastebasket. Time passes. 5 days, 4 days, 3 days, 1 day, 12 hours, 6 hours, and now 60 minutes. Imagine that you had only 1 hour left to live. What would come into your mind? What would you think about? What would you do in your last 60 minutes? My guess is that a face or faces would come into your mind. My guess is that you would think immediately and intensely about the person or persons that you would want to contact, to reach out and touch in your last 60 minutes. Could you get to them physically? Could you get them on the telephone? Where are they and what are they doing at this very moment? Are they accessible? Now, I don't know whose face or faces came into your mind. I only know one thing for sure. If you had only 60 minutes left to live, you would not be thinking, "Well, I'd sure like to get back to the office and return a few phone calls." The whole purpose of personal management, of time management, is to enable you to fulfill your responsibilities to the outside world so that you have more time to spend with the most important people in your life. It's so that you have more time to spend with a person or persons whose face would come into your mind if you learned that you only had a short time to live. The aim of time management is to allow you to spend more time with the people you love, doing more of the things you really enjoy. And the time to begin is now.